How does the state preserve its power, you might ask? Well, the answer is through a variety of methods, most mischievous in nature. Murray starts off by noting that force is their modus operandi. Their basic and long-run problem is ideological. For in order to continue in office, any government must have the support of the majority of its subjects. And as we'll see, we've never really had a majority rule, but nevertheless, the bureaucracy must be kept to a small minority of people for it to be effective. But people in power, or sometimes even one person in power, must have a following of people, and these people usually don't end up thinking for themselves. End quote here. For the masses of men do not create their own ideas or indeed think through these ideas independently. They follow passively the ideas adopted and disseminated by the body of intellectuals. The intellectuals are, therefore, the opinion molders in society. Now, another way the state does this is to seek out the intellectuals, because in the first place, they need to make everything they do seem plausible. Really think about that. So he says, it is evident that the state needs the intellectuals. It is not so evident why the intellectuals need the state. And he goes on to say, the state, on the other hand, is willing to offer the intellectuals a secure and permanent berth in the state apparatus, and thus a secure income in the panoply of prestige. Another interesting thing he mentions is, quote, the alliance between the state and the intellectuals was symbolized in the eager desire of professors at the University of Berlin in the 19th century from the intellectual bodyguard of the House of Hohenzollern. And he gives a quote by eminent Marxist scholar. The civilization which Professor Wittfogel is so bitterly attacking was one which could make poets and scholars into officials. You get a sense of why there's so much incompetency prevalent. It was set up to be that way. Now, in another paragraph, he lays out two arguments for why the public tends to favor the state. One is that the state rulers are great and wise men, much greater and wiser than the good but rather simple subjects. And two, that they rule by the extent that government is inevitable, absolutely necessary, and far better than the indescribable evils that would ensue upon its downfall. He also points out how religion is often misused to justify a tyrannical rulers. That is, if you're bashing the person oppressing you, it's blasphemy. It's just not true. The next particular example I feel is one of the most important lessons of the book, because he talks about how fear is ultimately instilled in the people, fear of alternative rule or non-rule. I'm going to quote this whole section because it's important. Especially has the state been successful in recent centuries in instilling fear of other state rulers. Since the land area of the globe has been parceled out among particular states, one of the basic doctrines of the state was to identify itself with the territory it governed. Since most men tend to love their homeland, the identification of that land and its people with the state was a means of making natural patriotism work to the state's advantage. And here's the important part. If Ruritania was being attacked by Moldavia, the first task of the state and the intellectuals was to convince the people of Ruritania that the attack was really upon them and not simply upon the ruling caste. In this way, a war between rulers was converted into a war between peoples, with each people coming into the defense of its rulers in the erroneous belief that the rulers were defending them. It was not too long ago that the mass of subjects regarded wars as irrelevant battles between various sets of nobles. Tradition is another tool. The longer that the rule of state has been able to preserve itself, the more powerful this weapon. Worship of one's ancestors, he says, then becomes a none too subtle means of worship of one's ancient rulers. The greatest danger of the state is independent intellectual criticism. Now, guilt is another tried and true myth, as Murray put it, in quote, any increase in private well-being can be attacked as unconscionable greed, materialism, or attacked as exploitation and usury. Mutually beneficial exchanges denounce as selfishness. So you really get the sense of the nasty tactics they use. And last but not least, the ultra-scientific views of the central planners. State rules, Murray says, is now proclaimed as being ultra-scientific, as constituting planning by experts. But while reason is invoked more than in previous centuries, this is not the true reason of the individual and his exercise of free will. So the use of science to justify state rule is preposterous. It's anything but scientific. What gives them more power is what's going to be deemed scientific. I'll end with this quote. A robber who justified his theft by saying that he really helped his victims by his spending giving a boost to retail trade would find few converts. But when this theory is clothed in Keynesian equations and impressive references to the multiplier effect, it unfortunately carries more conviction. And so the assault on common sense proceeds, each age performing the task in its own ways. So for next week, we'll finish up the chapters, and on Monday, we'll talk about how the state transcends its limits. But look out for the episode I put out with Dr. Walter Block next Friday. It's going to be a blast talking to him about the life of Murray Rothbard. See y'all then. Hey everyone, please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.